go. So a word or two about planning and continuing work on the final project. As you know, you have your groups. You're hopefully had at least some conversations over the last week or so. The goal for next week is to give me, as we've said, a short, don't overthink it, don't overwork this, no more than one page, really just a couple paragraphs, letting me know the topic that the five of you, the groups of five of you, have all agreed to as something you want to explore. So in theory, you will have had some discussions, you'll have some agreement, you'll done a little bit of exploration to figure out whether it's something we've talked about. You'll know it a little more than something we haven't, but anything is fair game. This is a anything that fits under the broad category of ethics and public health is applicable. And all I want is a couple paragraphs, no references, no, you know, big, complicated things, telling me what area you plan to focus your work on over the next month, and a little bit about how you choose to approach it. So, for example, if you guys had decided to think about a project on corporate responsibility and public and the ethics of public health, which would be a very interesting topic, you would say a little bit about why that's important and give me a few examples of areas in which you want to focus on a project that was organized. Again, that would be one of those projects organized around a concept with several applications worth studying. And for a project on corporate responsibility and the ethics of public health, you might talk about, what did I write down here? You could talk about tobacco advertising and marketing issues about that. You could talk about fast food portion sizes and healthy options and any responsibilities that exist therein. You might also talk about responsibilities of employers across the board to promote the health and wellness of their employees. That would be an example where you'd have a topic, you'd give a couple areas in which you would intend to explore and advocate for their consideration. Again, it should be a topic in which there isn't a great societal consensus, although just about everything we've talked about falls into that category, something that's interesting, timely, relevant, because what you'll be doing between now and August is making the case, developing the case for why the issue and its applications that you've identified are interesting, timely, relevant, and unresolved. So just a couple paragraphs to me. I will turn those around pretty quickly, mainly, and in most cases I suspect say, great, full speed ahead. It gives me a chance to say, way too big, you might want to narrow it down. Way too small, you might want to sort of pull back and think a little more broadly. Or if there are projects that are groups that are exactly on the same terrain, there's going to be some overlap. There are similar issues, there are similar themes. Some overlap is okay, but if there is, you know, an excessive amount, I might try to figure out ways in which group A might want to accentuate some part that they've identified, and group B might want to accentuate something else. So this is really just a checkpoint for all of us to make sure that we're moving forward, we're on the right track, and then off you go for the balance of the time. And we'll say more about next steps in a week or two. So questions about that? Cool. Feel free to email me if you do. So today we have several of our usual kickoff presentations and lots of I think, hopefully interesting questions and issues to discuss. This is a topic that I find particularly interesting because I'm still not exactly sure where I stand on some of these questions about strategies to promote healthy habits, health overall, particularly in the case of obesity and its consequences. So, what do I want to say here? Said a little bit of introduction. I want to do, some of our classes in this program, as you know, have far more sophisticated ways to assess people's perceptions and answers in real time. We can't afford clickers in this low-budget July summer class. But I wanted to go through a series, because what we've seen, we saw the Bloomberg policy as one particular proposal in a series, from what you've read and from what you may have seen over the past few years, a series of initiatives that take different concrete actions by government, state, federal, local, by regulators to change behaviors in order to promote healthier eating habits and reduce obesity and its many consequences. So I wanted to go through a series of proposals and just do a quick shows of hands about people's perceptions. This is a forced choice. I know these issues are complicated. I know details matter. I know things are contingent. I understand that. But just as a general proposition for each of the 9 or 10 various proposals that have been floated out there as potential solutions to the problem that there's pretty strong evidence exists and needs to be improved upon going forward for the health of the nation. I'm curious as to how many people, as a general proposition, favor each of the following initiatives: real, imagined, possible, proposed. So, for example, how many people are in favor of a standardized nutritional label for packaged food in the supermarket? The kinds of things we have, the kinds of things here on the back of my Coke Zero, a standardized program. What's the, and you must choose. So just about everybody. That's on purpose. How about the thing that's happened here in Philadelphia, it's happened in New York, the mandatory posted calorie counts on fast food menus, on restaurants that have more than a certain number of establishments, so even steakhouses, chain steakhouses, the mandatory calorie counts posted as customers make decisions about ordering. Okay, so a few hands have dropped down. How about the proposals that have been implemented in many places now, the all-out ban on trans fat as a cooking ingredient to be replaced by other fats, other frying oils, the trans fat, particularly harmful ingredient outlawed in New York, I think in Philadelphia and elsewhere. How many people are in favor of that ban? Okay. Schools. Lots of initiatives underway to restrict sugar-sweetened beverages, sodas, sugary juices, junk food from vending machines, certainly the nutrition of public food, public school food menus. How many people are in favor of those pretty significant restrictions on school menus? Okay, good. Also a large majority. Taxes. Obviously, taxes vary based on how large they are and how they're implemented, but as a general area to change behavior, taxing sugar sweetened, this is not sugar sweetened, but taxing the regular Coke, sugary drinks as an attempt to deter, get people to drink other things. Taxes as an intervention. Okay, now we're still in the probably 75% or so. This kind of proposal, banning large portions. Everything's still available, but the amount could be a drink, it could be food. We could imagine doing it for, you know, the different fast food, how much by weight, I guess, how many, you know, how large the order of French fries could be. How about using restrictions on portion sizes available in a single purchase or in a single unit, again, as an attempt to encourage healthier eating habits, so banning larger portions. Okay, so we're under probably a quarter there. This may be out of order, but this happened in San Francisco. Happy Meal toys are now banned. You can't give away toys as part of fast food meals. Now, here's where policy, you know, meets public health. Now at McDonald's in San Francisco in the Bay Area, you can buy a toy for 10 cents with the purchase of a Happy Meal, which is completely above board. But the free toys as part of children's meals was banned by referendum in San Francisco, and that's in effect now. How many people are in favor of that proposal?
Can you buy the toy without the Happy Meal?
I don't know. It's a good question.
Because for people only buy it in order to get the toy.
Yes. Now you're complicating things. Well, let's say you could only get it with the Happy Meal, but you had to throw in a dime just to simplify things. People in favor of that prohibition? Okay, virtually nobody, or maybe nobody. I was going to say, but I think I already know where you're going. Just do the full, you know, obesity dream. What's the outright ban of soda? Shut it down. Contraband. You know, prohibition. Ken Burns will do a documentary about people breaking open 2-liter bottles of soda and pouring it in the sewers 50 years from now. Is there anyone who would? I'd be interested to hear the devil's advocate case, but I'm going to assume there's no one for that. All right, one or two more. How about this one? And this will come up. This will be floated in the coming months in the wake of the Supreme Court decision. I'm sure you heard the arguments people tried to compare purchasing health insurance, especially opponents of the Affordable Care Act would say, oh, then the government could make you buy broccoli. And thoughtful critics noted that that's a very different type of commerce to be regulated. However, given that the decision supported the insurance mandate as a tax, it does certainly open the door. This broccoli argument actually does have legs now, or whatever broccoli has. I don't need enough broccoli to make the joke about what the term would be, but it would have worked if I had. we could imagine, and it sounds like the Constitution would permit, a penalty for individuals who do not purchase by showing you cash register receipts and things like that. If you didn't purchase a set amount of foods from a specified list of healthy foods, you could imagine green vegetables and maybe lean meats, a penalty to encourage healthy purchases of those things. It's not quite requiring people to buy broccoli, but having this penalty for people who don't purchase enough of a good-for-you kinds of food. Any takers on that one? Nobody. You will hear it, and you will say, you heard it here first on July 5th. Last few ones just to look at our analog case, and then we'll hear about today's readings. Mandatory seatbelt laws. Are we good on mandatory seatbelt laws? Anybody opposed to it? Any dyed-in-the-wool libertarians? I'm happy. All voices are welcome here. No? Mandatory helmet laws for adults. This is what we'll hear about today. Who's in favor of mandatory helmet laws for adults? Basically. Was there anybody who's in favor of one and not the other? Okay, we're going to come back to that because that's interesting. And I think we've made the point. So a range of things. We can see our own attitudes changing somewhere along this continuum from education to this Cass Sunstein libertarian paternalism nudging, which is what Bloomberg, as you heard his little clip there on MSNBC, is basically what he's saying. Everything's still available, but just there are, you know, subtle cues that make it a little more difficult for people to do things that the government, specifically the public health folks, don't want you to do. So that's that nudge idea out to the restriction, taxing, and outright ban. So this is this continuum of interventions that we hear about in obesity and other applications that we'll hear from our folks today, who will remind me who they are in a minute. I know John is one of them. John, Emily, and Arjun will take us through the reading. So again, my weekly plea, short is great. Please no more than 10 minutes for each of you. And then we have lots of I suspect, issues to dig into after we hear from our very limited, by the way, set of readings. And this is closer to the norm for the amount of reading you will have for the balance of the weeks. Next week is a bit of a heavier week, but deliberately as we wind down, and in theory you're devoting time to some of the final project work, the last 2 weeks in particular are much closer to this more limited amount of reading. There's lots of things I wanted to get out on the table as we started, but now we'll go fewer, shorter pieces, which will allow us to dig into a little bit more depth. So with that, John, Emily, Arjun, whoever of you wants to start. There's John. Where's Emily? There's Arjun here?
Yeah.
Arjun's here. So you guys can shoot. Whoever wants to go first, ABC, makes no difference.
Kind of follows what you've been talking about.
Please.
I had the two Brownell articles, and the first one was personal responsibility and obesity. And it's basically just about how personal responsibility has sort of been the centerpiece of the food industry argument. They have talked about how government demonizes the food industry and violates personal freedoms. It's been a libertarian argument. And they really equated obesity with personal failures and vices. And there have been some comparisons of government control of their food as well as rationing from World War II and whatnot. And their efforts to, you know, sort of hold off on any kind of regulation were successful for a while. So they blocked a lot of school interventions, and they used extensive lobbying and ad campaigns to do it. In fact, we were going to do parliamentary against food taxes and proposed legislation like the Personal Responsibility in Food Consumption Act, which was supposed to ban lawsuits against the fast food industry, sort of as a blanket. And with Obama in office, a lot of the climate has really changed. There's become a much bigger focus on public health as opposed to individual-centered models. And so the article just talked about how they looked at different health behaviors and saw that, in general, responsibility is actually increasing over the past few years. So they kind of ruled out the idea that people are becoming less responsible. And they found that they concluded, I guess, that the food environment is really changing. So supermarket diets that are filled with fat and sugar and all sorts of unhealthy things, and they are, it's pretty clear that they're at they're contributing to weight gain and worsened health among the public in general. And, you know, they cited the Pima Indians who, you know, a group was living in Mexico and a group was living in Arizona. In Mexico, they were really healthy, low incidence of diabetes, and in Arizona they had one of the highest incidences of diabetes. And other things that have sort of general trends, like rising portions, increasing amounts of sugar in food, and the idea that sugar might even be addictive. So he, or they, said that education would be sort of the focus of Bush administration's approach to food regulation was really not working that well. But and they thought that, they think that it doesn't have to be either an individual choice approach versus a individual responsibility versus a collective responsibility. So it can actually be a blend of both. And they thought that the optimal default, which is the idea of making creating better options, that actually gives people more freedom by giving them information to make informed decisions and smart decisions. And so they outlined four different potential policy approaches. The first is to sort of frame children as victims and, you know, their efforts to protect children. You know, food marketing often goes under the radar for people who can't distinguish, kids who can't distinguish between programming versus advertising. It can be really detrimental to sort of their ideas about nutrition and their own eating habits. And then they can, you know, there have been a series of school policy successes over the past few years. Another approach is to really push sort of the accurate information. They talk about the information asymmetries in the marketplace, and consumers need truthful information to make smart choices. So if they think something's healthy and it's actually not, you know, they're not really able to make smart choices. So, you know, policymakers could really sort of focus on that. And some of the, you know, the menu labeling and whatnot has been around that issue, trying to, you know, show people what is in the foods that they're choosing. They also talk about how self-regulation by the food industry doesn't really work. So programs like the Smart Choices, they ended up putting labels on foods like mayonnaise and things like that, so they could kind of manipulate it in any way they want. So they were advocating a departure from relying on self-regulation among the food industry. Their third suggestion was that policymakers could focus on regulating food marketing. They use stealthy approaches to target kids especially, and that really undermines the whole idea of personal responsibility, because if you're working with inaccurate information, you can't make, you know, responsible informed choices. And they also talk about how the government can actually set tighter standards itself for, you know, what foods can be produced and whatnot. And then the last thing they talked about was regulating food ingredients themselves. So, you know, the ban on trans fat. The government can actually create standards through legislation or administrative regulation that straight out ban certain ingredients. Actually, one more. The last one was the food taxes, which we've talked about a little bit. I mean, this is the most controversial, but they talked about how sugar-sweetened beverages are such big, you know, problems in Americans' diets, and how that's an easy first place to start with regulation. And I guess their conclusion was really that we can create conditions that support healthy eating and healthy lifestyle and personal responsibility, and that the current conditions promote obesity. It doesn't reduce personal response. It actually supports personal responsibility to create better options. They're not mutually exclusive, the personal responsibility approach and collective approach, but that they can actually work together. And So that was the first article. And the second article was Ounces of Prevention, which is really about food taxes on sugar, sweetened beverages. And they just talked about how bad the obesity epidemic is right now, and how taxing sugar sweetened beverages could really help. So 40 states already have it, and at the time that this was published, New York and Maine were considering it. And they talked about how sugar sweetened beverages are the largest driver of the obesity epidemic. And there's all sorts of studies that show that link increased consumption with increased weight gain and worsened health outcomes and things like diabetes. And they talk about extensive food marketing to kids and how it's becoming, sugar sweetened beverages are actually constitute 10 to 15% of children and teens' overall calories. So some kind of startling statistics. And how that's really on the rise from, even a few decades ago. And they talked about how a food tax would reduce consumption, or, is predicted to reduce consumption, but even a small tax could have relatively big effect. So they said they expected that a 10% increase in price would lead to a 7.8% consumption reduction in consumption, or higher. So it would encourage consumption of healthier drinks and to replace the unhealthy drinks, which would lead to less calories and less weight gain. And they talked about the penny per ounce tax, which was proposed, where it was expected to reduce consumption by 13%, which would lead to 8,000 less calories per year per person, and 2 pounds of weight loss per year, which is actually pretty substantial. And the idea was just that a really small tax could have a really big impact. The main anti-tax arguments are that the government shouldn't interfere in the marketplace and that consumer demand dictate prices, that tax is regressive, although the rebuttal of that is that a lot of these diseases are regressive too. So, taxing sugar-sweetened beverages would really help poorer populations because they drink a disproportionate amount of them and they're disproportionately affected by diet-related diseases. They talk about, they admit that food isn't the same as tobacco. You actually need food to live, unlike tobacco. The rebuttal to that was that we don't need sugar beverages to live, so even without soda, everyone would still be fine. And then another big argument was that, and this is kind of what John Stewart was poking fun at, is that just removing or reducing soda in the diet isn't going to solve the obesity crisis alone. There's a lot of other factors. And the rebuttal that they provided to that is that just because it won't single-handedly solve the problem doesn't justify inaction, which is actually kind of an interesting to talk about. But the main pro-tax arguments were externality, which is that the cost of sugar-sweetened beverages falls on parties who aren't involved in actual transactions. So either, I think it was over half of the medical costs that are generated, so it says $79 billion is spent annually for overweight and obesity alone, and half of that is paid by Medicare and Medicaid. So, the food industry and the people who are consuming the beverages aren't paying for a good portion of it. And it's really driving health costs, healthcare costs. And society is also paying in terms of decreased work productivity, increased absenteeism, poor school performance, reduced fitness for military recruits. The other pro-tax argument was the information asymmetry that exists in the marketplace, where there's a lot of misleading health claims around food, and it's exploitative, exploits young kids and exploits adults too. And that you could actually reinvest the revenue from the tax into obesity prevention efforts or subsidizing healthier foods. And that's actually the third. Pro-tax argument is that it is a health-promoting way to generate revenue in a time when we're pretty cash-strapped and really need revenue. So the penny per ounce program would generate $1.2 billion in New York alone. So, you know, other generating revenue and health promoting ways beats other options. And public sentiment actually, there's a lot of public support for food taxes if you are going to reinvest that money into obesity prevention efforts. So they also talk about the two different types of tax, sales versus excise. And they were saying that excise tax would be more appropriate for this. And, you know, overall, I think the point was that education really is not cutting it. And a food tax would not only reduce consumption, but would also produce revenue that could be used in really helpful and significant ways.
Thanks very much. Yes?
I think mine were kind of similar to what I was seeing. I prepared the Faden and the Mello articles.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll talk about the Faden one first, because the Mello one, you can kind of use some of the frameworks that Faden establishes to kind of dig into that one. So she kind of starts off by just looking at health campaigns used by the government, and she decides to focus on communications campaigns because they're very prominent among government interventions in public health. So she starts off by giving some of the criticisms that it's not cost-effective, that maybe it's a token effort by the government, and that the one that comes up a lot, that it's too invasive and it limits civil liberties. And she also further goes on to say that for a long time, these initiatives were thought to not be successful. Until recently, she cites a series of particular interventions that were successful. And in particular, she talks about changing the perception of the public over time. And she gets back to that in the conclusion as well. The examples that she gives in particular are smoking and seatbelts. And I think that's interesting when we get to her four criteria, which I'll talk about in a minute. But then she brings up the balance of autonomy and justice, because we talked about earlier in the class where in public health efforts, it's very difficult to not limit autonomy in any way. And so she feels like there has to be a balance, which makes a lot of sense. So she brings up four criteria, and I think it's important to emphasize that the four criteria don't all have to be met, but because also they're not all going to play on the same people. So, you know, it could draw on one of them very strongly, and a lot of people would respond to that. And the four that she brings up are the government's responsibility to protect and promote public health. Public efficiency, which is sort of just there are certain public health goals that people have that would need to be implemented in a state collective fashion. And the last two are the two that I thought would be most well received by a lot of Americans. And they were reducing healthcare costs and reducing harm to others. And the reason why I thought that those would be the most important were, first of all, they have tangible, measurable results. And secondly, the first two are more focused on the public, whereas I feel like in the United States, we do have a very individualized sense. So the last two, you can take them and say, oh, how is this going to benefit me right now? So, and I think that's why smoking and seatbelts, and this is a hypothesis, but I think that's why smoking and seatbelts have had over time, their campaigns have been able to change the perception, because with both of them, it's been clearly demonstrated that smoking and not using seatbelts can not only harm the person who's involved in it, but other people as well. And it's pretty clearly shown that they can reduce healthcare costs by, so it's a clear benefit to society. And that's why I think it's interesting to look at whether healthy eating would fall into that. I think it's pretty clear that it would reduce healthcare costs, but I think it's a little bit less obvious to say that it would directly reduce harm to others. Whereas with seatbelts and smoking, you can make a direct relationship between the use of smoking and the non-use of seatbelts and harm to others. So I just thought that was interesting. Then the next thing she talks about is, I thought sort of like she was taking informed consent from an individual perspective and kind of applying it to a public health more global, not like global in the sense of the world, but like a larger perspective. And when she was talking about persuasion versus manipulation, I think I'll talk about that more when I get to the Mella one, because I think I think you can use this framework, the four criteria and the persuasion versus manipulation, to justify the two initiatives that they talk about. And then I wanted to compare that to the soda tax. I'm sure the soda ban, which I'm sure will, the large size soda ban, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, so I won't talk about too much. The last thing that I thought was pretty interesting from this one that, that Beth actually brought up when we were talking about it was just that Faden talks about how one strong argument is that the government needs to intervene to prevent attitudes and behavior from being shaped by the commercial market. I think that's a really interesting point, because when you have basically she compares the government, their initiatives to advertising, but for basically public health good. I mean, to say good would be obviously subjective, but I think their goal is at least for public good. Whereas commercial sector, I don't think their goal would be as much for the public good, rather it would be for profit. So especially in the short term, if you look at it, it seems dangerous to trust a group that's going to advertise for profit versus a group that's going to advertise for what they perceive as a public good. So I think it's irrelevant whether it is actually public good, because that's what their goal is versus a goal that's not. And I think that she kind of talks about a rebuttal to that being, well, the government could ban, rather than just, doing these kind of approaches, they could ban stuff. And I think it's difficult to do that, because if you look at trans fats or like high fructose corn syrup, which I don't think it's banned, but it could be, you look at something that's a particular entity that can be harmful. Whereas when you look at a lot of other factors that are important in that lead to obesity, like soda or fatty foods or things that are high in salt, it's not like if I eat a bag of potato chips or some French fries today, it's going to cause a problem. I mean, I guess you could say that also for high fructose corn syrup, but the difference is that a lot of people could eat those things in moderation and not have a problem. So I think it's difficult to have an all-out ban on soda, for instance. And that isn't really relevant to the current ban, because it's the size issue, but just response to her rebuttal. And then she kind of gets at the end back to how these public health initiatives hopefully are causing a change in perception, like in seatbelts and smoking. And so the second article was looking at New York City, and the two kind of things that they talk about the most are banning trans fat, I guess three. So banning trans fat in fast food establishments, requiring labs to report high levels of glycated hemoglobin to a citywide registry to combat diabetes. That one they didn't really focus on much, because it just seems like something that not a lot of people would necessarily disagree with. And the last one was the chain restaurants posting calorie information. And so I think if you look at the chain restaurants posting the calorie information, that's one where you can, I think, pretty clearly say that if you look at persuasion versus manipulation, it falls clearly in the persuasion category, because it's just trying to put out more factual information that will help somebody make an informed decision. It's not trying to manipulate someone necessarily to not eat those foods, just trying to get them to understand the potential consequences when they're making that decision. And they talked about why it was justified legally. And they just said that it's factual and uncontroversial. So the argument that the other side was taking was that they're singling out calories and making it seem like it's more important than it actually is. But the court disagreed with that, so it was a factual evidence that is uncontroversial and can help, so there's no reason to ban it. With the trans fat, with some of the statistics, I think it's pretty clear that, sort of like what I was saying with high fructose corn syrup, it's one thing that it stands out as especially dangerous. And I don't know enough about high fructose corn syrup, so somebody might be like, no, that's ridiculous. So just focusing on the trans fats. I think it's, they said 23% of, so they said that heart disease is the number one killer in New York, and they said that by banning trans fats and replacing with other alternatives, they can reduce 23% of people with heart disease. So that, I mean, that's a very clear relationship that is supported. So that one, again, I think it would fall into a lot of the categories, reducing harm, reducing healthcare costs for sure. And it, also, if you look at the hospitalization, it costs the city $481 million, 75% paid by Medicaid and Medicare. So, you know, there's a clear benefit for New Yorkers. And I think it would also play on number one, responsibility to protect and promote public health. When you know this kind of information, it seems irresponsible to not do something about it. Then the thing that they talk about at the end was kind of interesting too. So they say that their kind of conclusions were that government has a tremendous power in reducing chronic disease based on the rulings that were decided in these cases. But they say that there's a lot of danger associated with decentralized approaches like these ones. Because it just gets very confusing with different jurisdictions coming into play. But at the same time, I think that there has to be some kind of precedent in a smaller jurisdiction at times, because there are certain controversial approaches like this one that probably wouldn't get approved federally, you know, so it has to start somewhere. I think one thing that was interesting to me also is if you look at the current, the ban on the over 16-ounce sodas, if you look at the criteria, it fits into the reduced healthcare costs probably, but I think the reduced harm to others, it doesn't really necessarily fit into, because you can make arguments on both sides probably, because I read another article in the New York Times that was talking about how it's going to affect a lot of local bodegas, which is where a lot of low economic status people get food from. And so what their argument was rather than spending the money on, you know, banning soda, why not make healthier food more accessible in parks, you know, places to exercise more accessible to these people, rather than hurting local businesses that maybe the only places that provide food for these individuals. So I think that was an interesting point, because I probably was leaning more towards the other side, and now I'm probably leaning towards the side that's against the tax, but I'm really undecided. I mean, I just think there's good points on both sides. So that was kind of what I got out of those two articles.
Thanks. John, tell us about motorcycle helmets.
So I can tell us about motorcycle helmets. So the chapter is the paternalism and its discontents. I want to give you a pinch of history of the issue in the United States, which is interesting from a judicial and legislative perspective and how they kind of are discordant. So I hope we bring us together with obesity and kind of think of something of a bargaining themes around the harm principle. So the motorcycle story really starts getting rolling in the United States in 1966 in the setting of increased awareness of highway safety. There's a law, the National Highway Safety Act, passed that suggests that there will be withholding of federal funds to states if they do not pass helmet laws. So states get the clue in the following 9 years, until 75, we go from 3 states with laws, all but California passing motorcycle laws. This change is not without objection in the courts and a swell of lobbyists. So let's talk about the courts first. There's a number of challenges in more than 10 states. And then two, in Illinois and Michigan, these laws are found to be unconstitutional. And in those court cases, the deciding judges reference the harm principle, and they suggest, as lovely as it is that these things will be preventing disability and postponing untimely death, it is still my choice whether I put on this helmet, and it ends with me putting it on top of my head. In states that did not disagree, they took the issue head on, and they found that not wear a helmet was a other regarding harm, was something that would compose a cost on others. I just want to quote the Massachusetts court. Society picks up the person off the highway, delivers them to a municipal hospital, and the doctors provide them with unemployment compensation if, after recovery, he cannot replace his lost job. And if the injury causes permanent disability, they assume responsibility for his and his family continued subsistence. We do not understand a state of mind that permits the plaintiff to think that only he himself is concerned. So Massachusetts was in the majority in most of these courts of upholding the challenge. That being said, the legislature did not stand the test of time in the same way against the anti-helmet lobby. So large groups of, while reading, imagine like motorcycle revving, motivated with the leather jacket, coming forth and creating multiple sides that made very good arguments based on the Ninth Amendment and focusing on this right to choose that nicely at that time paralleled some of the reproductive rights movement as this kind of right to choose as a buzz term. And they found their arguments reached the heart of several senators and found that, there's some nice passages in there from senators saying, I'm not jeopardizing others with this choice. So in 1976, there was a revision to this law that revoked the federal authority to withhold funds. And as soon as states are freed, 28 states make a change. 8 states repeal the law altogether, and 20 states limit their law to minors. This is a unfortunate experimental model for what's going to happen to your new riders, and there's a 20% increased death from crashes, there's increase in 200% cost of metal costs in non-helmeted individuals. So in the 80s, people with public health degrees and doctors and anyone affiliated with health is appalled and writing about how they need to help people protect themselves. A good society sees these things and looks to try and move forward together. So in that setting, in the late 80s, also this is during right around where there's starting to be some seatbelt mandates, Senator Jaffe introduces the National Highway Fatality and Injury Reduction Act. This is a lighter form of what we saw in 66. It says you hold 10% of your funds if you don't have an adequate helmet law. At this point, we start to really, this chapter really focuses on the concept anti-paternalism being the motivation argument. There are several passages about how the resistance from lobbies and from certain political centers were the parallel to you're going to choose my diet, you're going to choose my nutrition, or once I put a helmet on, who's to say I don't need an armored suit, or who's to say I don't need to be in the little Robin car next to the Batmobile. With all Jaffe's efforts, all he can muster for it in 91 is that the nation can hold 3% of funds from a state. Continued efforts from this abate lobby, and in 95, that's even removed. Fast forward to now, what are we looking at? We have 19 states in D.C. that have universal laws. We have 28 states that have partial laws. When we think partial, we think 21 and under are mandated. And in some states, if you opt not to wear a helmet, you need to have $10,000 in health insurance, which is an interesting kind of a look at, is this other regarding, and do we need to have some extra protection for my individual choice? And 3 states have no law. And then so neatly timed, 2 weeks ago, CDC did a morbidity and mortality weekly report on motorcycle helmets, and give you some of the facts about this. So less than 1% of vehicle miles travels are in motorcycles. 14% of road deaths happen on a motorcycle. For every state that has a universal law versus a partial law, they save $725 per motorist. For all the people that wore helmets last year, the nation saved $3 billion. All motorcyclists, including ones who are not wearing helmets, there was an estimate in savings of $1.4 billion. And then all these times when you passed a law, turned it over, passed a law, turned it over, is excellent for epidemiologists. And I'll just bring us for Florida. For the 2 years, there was a switch in 2000, 2 years before and 2 years after. That change of universal law to a partial law, there was an increase in 21% in the death rate of all motorcyclists. Increase of 80% in motorcycle head injury hospital admissions. And the cost for Florida's all, as a state, paid for motorcyclists in hospitals went from 21 million to 50 million. All that I could have just said in one sentence, I could have said we know helmet legislation saves lives and money. But what we are interested in about, and especially in this kind of kind theme together, is really about this harm as well. We nicely had in week one the paper discussed the stewardship model, maybe ringing a bell, and even if we look at the harm principle, you can look at it very strictly and say, any choice, any time that I'm not directly harming, someone else, there shouldn't be any legislation. But in the stewardship model, which is, I thought, was a nice generous one, we see things like we can promote health not only by providing information and advice, but also with programs to help people overcome addictions and other healthy behaviors. So would wearing a helmet be a program to, or is it simply, in terms of constraint, these programs, this is even in the stewardship model, should not attempt to coerce adults to lead healthy lives. So is a mandate inherently coercive, even in our institution model? And we can also go back to another week one paper, which was mapping the terrain, and we talked about whether something is within the domain of public health or is it paternalism. And it really splits on, is your voluntary choice, is it self-regarding or is it other-regarding? And with in previous weeks, with infectious disease, with vaccines, there's a clear externality of your action, right? There's a clear other regarding harm. Obesity is, and motorcycles, microbes, helmets, you have to ask yourself, is cost to society, dollars and cents, enough of a other regarding harm? If no, then the Ninth Amendment violation, infringement on autonomy, should not, we have a violation of harm principle and this is stepping too far. If cost is enough of another regarding harm, it should guide our thoughts about more than just obesity and motorcycle, but nutrition and really, when does the dollar and cents end? When can we decide, I'm blanking on the example, but I think any, as soon as it comes down to, the fact that I take this path to work instead of this way, I walk over a certain amount of grass and then we have to pay for this. When does our regulation end? And I also just wanted to, thinking about the stewardship model, I wanted to think of other things that could be alternative to helmet mandates, right? So if we're supposed to promote programs to make better choices, but only to try and create the best, should there just be helmet exchanges everywhere? Everywhere you get a bike, there's a guy outside, take it. Or should, you can't mandate, it's inherently coercive to wear it, but what if anyone who sold that motorcycle had to affix a helmet to it with a cord? And so you could drive around and I got it, I'm not wearing it, but it's always there. So
it would be a problem though in the first motorcycle accident when that's affixed to your head and you go flying. We'll work out the details.
He's be forced to sell it with the helmet.
Exactly. But I think, we had a lot of hands go up, so I thought, I wasn't sure, but if we think about this just in general ethical schemes, utilitarian, it's a new pro-law. This is greatest aggregate benefit, right? We're getting a lot of, we're going to save money, we're going to save lives, what can be better? The social contract, the collectivist will say, this is pro-community, we're keeping alive. But the conservative libertarian and has a very good point based in Mill that, if we don't think cost is another guarding harm, at the end of the day, I can wear a pineapple on my head, right? It's my motorcycle, and what's wrong with that?
Cool. Thank you very much. Thanks to all three of you. Lots of things I hope we can touch upon in the next hour or so. My number one on my little cheat sheet of things I hope we will chat about is this question of externalities. We heard it in different contexts, from different readings, from different authors, used in different ways. And I think it's an important one for us to explore, as John was suggesting, how it works and what limits that can have as a rationale for government intervention. I think in these cases, in all the cases, and you know, we'll weave in the motorcycle helmet example as we go along. It's an interesting one, and it's one of those ones in which the tide is turning. Governor Rendell, certainly no libertarian, before he left office, signed a law that reduced or lessened the severity of the motorcycle helmet law in Pennsylvania. Again, it's one of those, if you're over 21 and you've had your license for a few years, you don't have to wear a helmet in Pennsylvania. That dialed it back from what it had been previously. So it's a very different story, as we hear from the Bayer paper, about citizen activists. We heard about them in the early days of HIV/AIDS. We hear about them in other contexts. But this is a case where clearly a different kind of activism is working. So we'll weave that back in, and certainly the role of cost in that story, because it's a different one than what seems to be the momentum for obesity. So you'll hear two general arguments. Once people, in the obesity case, once people recognize there's a need, so we're thinking about, if we want to think about, you know, the necessary part of the Childress et al. Criteria, you show all the severity of the obesity problem and, you know, the failure of the status quo to change behaviors. The two arguments that generally circulate about why government intervention is appropriate, once you've shown that it's necessary, is, in one corner, the ethicists, the public health diehards, the true blue folks who say, like Ron Bayer, it's good for you. Government, you know, if you can't make the right decisions, government has a responsibility to help you make those good choices for yourself. That doesn't get a lot of play in the policy discussion for reasons that are probably obvious, but it certainly informs a lot of these debates. But the one that absolutely shows up that says this is why intervening in obesity is similar to why requiring vaccines or isolation and quarantine is this idea that the externalities, that the cost to the healthcare system for people who are uninsured, who show up in emergency rooms, for the overall cost to Medicare, Medicaid, and other publicly financed healthcare systems, that those things mean that individual choices have this community benefit, or have this community consequence, such that intervention is required. So I'm curious whether people think that's a sufficient justification for anywhere along the spectrum of interventions that we heard about, that I rattled through there. Is that sufficient cause to intervene? And if it is, then why, to John's point, do hands start dropping off somewhere along the continuum? If we're intervening, why stop at some point there? Jeff, start us off.
I'm kind of pumping the question a little bit further down the field, but I think one way to frame it is that it is the question we need to actually ask. I don't think it's a priori something that, say, a social contract theory would direct us toward, upon, like, say, preventing murder, which social contract theory, you know, that's a slam dunk. Talking about externalities is legitimately in the gray area, and that's the problem, is that some people don't, some people do. I mean, I personally do, but we live in a society where people simply don't have the same conception of the good there, unlike with other things that are less disputed. And so I don't know if there's a good answer other than saying this is the question of public health and we're going to keep pushing it and hopefully we'll convince more people and eventually pass the laws.
Mm-hmm. Emily Menard.
Well, I just keep thinking, so as I was reading through this and thinking a lot of things, I kept comparing it to tobacco and thinking, well, how is it similar, how is it different? And I think that the question of where to draw the line has a lot to do with how much evidence there is and how bad it would be not to do something about it. So, like, how high the stakes are and how much evidence there is that would actually really be such a pivotal, you know, policy decision. Obviously, for smoking, there was enough evidence. And, I mean, it sounds like for certain, you know, nutritional, like, I'm not sure exactly what it would be, but I feel like you might be able to make that argument that for some things there's a high enough, you know, proven link to weight gain or diabetes or heart disease or whatever it might be. So I kind of think like that's what determines where you draw the line. And I mean, I'm pretty pro public health, so I was pretty convinced by the obesity articles. But I imagine to make a stronger case, like, we just need stronger evidence.
Okay, so evidence. So great. So let's, you know, table the tobacco discussion until next week. Interesting, important, a good comparison that we'll have to think about when we're there. But the role of evidence, some sort of critical mass threshold, and that as sort of maybe a tipping point effect there. Arden?
Yeah, I was going to say something similar to Emily. I think just adding one thing to it is just, I think the first line would be, does it cause harm, direct harm to other people? Like, with, I know we're talking about smoking actually, but just quickly, like smoking would be clearly something that causes harm to others directly. And I think that's a point where libertarians would agree with, because, you know, they're in favor of, I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth that's a libertarian, but it seems like they're...
As you say, where he's out.
But it seems like they're in favor of personal liberties, and when one person's personal liberty blocks another, you know, that, then it becomes a problem. So I think that's the first line, and then I agree with you, the second line would be how much evidence there is. And I think that kind of goes back to like the trans fat thing. You know, there's clear evidence of how... And I think, I mean, with the motorcycle helmet thing, I mean, you could say a similar argument, just interesting that, you know, what would be the difference there? Because there's also clear evidence that wearing a helmet, you know, has positive consequences. I don't know.
You know, if we really cared about cost, we would just ban... It's a lot cheaper to ban it all together, like tobacco. I mean, we can talk about that next week. You could just ban tobacco, and we spend a lot on anti-smoking and all that sort of stuff. So if you really care about cost, you can just ban it. I sort of... And I answered yes to some of the tax things, and you know, I'm probably more on the conservative side, although I don't think I'm technical at all, so I'm certainly not a John Stewart. But we tax things all the time, and we ban things. I mean, we banned saccharin many years ago. You know, sure, there was some uproar, but there's if it's harmful, that's okay to ban something that's harmful. I mean, that's a part of what public health is. But let's just ban it and not spend all this money trying to convince people that it's not good for you or something of that nature.
It does turn the cost thing on its side, absolutely, the money that goes into it.
But I don't think it's feasible to ban anything without convincing people that something's bad. Right? When we were watching the John Stewart clip from the beginning, I was thinking about, I watch him pretty regularly, and all that week, he kept coming back to that issue. And one thing that he kept... doing for like all the guests that came on that week was there was another proposal that was like you could have up to an ounce of marijuana on you and just be fined like $100, and I guess the fine for the sodas was like $200. He kept putting like a cup of soda and a cup of weed on the table and being like $200 for the soda, $100 for the weed. Like, and that's, I mean, I agree with him, that seems ridiculous, but if you think about it, like, I mean, I would like to know how many people per year die as a result of their obesity, and how many people die a year as a result of smoking too much marijuana? I mean, probably more people die from their
Absolutely.
Obesity. I mean, you know, those are very crude. I know there's too many variables. You couldn't really actually do that. But you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But my point is that marijuana feels bad. You know, that's illegal. And soda feels like that's fine. So my point is, I think it's about changing the perception.
Mm-hmm. And I think seatbelts are an area where we've heard that has become, you know, lawyers refer to subtle law. You're not going to find a lot of, there may be some anti-seatbelt lobby somewhere on the internet. There's something. There's anti-germ theory people. There are the AIDS denialists. I suspect there is some group out there that is fighting hard with writing letters to, you know, poor congressional staffers about you know, repealing seatbelt laws. But that's a point where there has been a societal shift. And I guess the question is then how to get there, how to change those attitudes if there is a sufficient good identified worth intervening in. Someone was over here, and then we'll shoot back here. Yes, Lindsay.
So, taking off that point, I'm a public health student. I'm for public health initiatives, but I have a really, really hard time with the taxing soda. I just, in my mind, I cannot figure out how that is going to do any good, and I feel like it's too political to, you know, throw out there. And I've been working with the food trust this summer and doing their corner store initiative, which is go to all the little corner stores and, you know, give them vegetables and food. And I don't see how the person that is going to be consuming the beverage is going to feel the tax, and corner stores are going to eat up the cost, and it's going to be replaced elsewhere, and I don't think it's going to be effective. With that, I also think that initiatives that are additive as opposed to restrictive are much more successful. introducing other options versus banning something is always, in public, in the realm of public health, that's always going to be an easier sell. And I think it's almost more ethical to, you know, increase options as opposed to just, you know, start restricting things on, you know, all out restricting things or taxing things or, you know, all these different.
To Lindsay's point, then I'll go John and Josh. I wanted to say something about, you know, so many of these stories in the history of public health and today tend to focus on the New York City Health Department for historical reasons, but the fact that they are the leading, usually the leading agents of initiatives like this. The example, the Brownell and Frieden paper was written by Thomas Frieden, who it was April 30th, 2009. He's credited as the health commissioner for New York, but as we noted when we read something else by him, he had just, probably while this was in print, shifted to the CDC commissioner. So, you know, he was part of these earlier initiatives. The current administration in the health department, from the mayor on down, who has great control over these things, tends to be, you know, very proactive in these sorts of programs. Philadelphia, as you may know, over the last couple of years, tried a similar soda tax. Well, not that New York has tried a soda tax, but Philadelphia has tried on two occasions a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages in 2010 and 2011. They failed both times. I like Mayor Nutter. We went to the same high school. He defeated, you know, he got elected despite not being part of the Democratic machine. But in both cases, it was unsuccessful, and it was probably unsuccessful because, in part because of messaging and in part because of practicality. We heard in one of the Brownell pieces the revenue idea that, you know, oh yeah, public health is good, but this, you know, times are strapped, you know, we can raise a lot of money this way. And that argument, the first time that Mayor Nutter in 2010 introduced what would have been a 2 cent per ounce tax, which is significant. You think about a 2 liter bottle of soda is something, I did the math earlier, something like 65 ounces. So we know that's $1.30 right there. And you buy a 2 liter bottle at a supermarket, it's usually not much more than $1.30. So that's a significant tax. You know, on a 12 ounce can, 25 cents, it's still a significant in percent term tax. At the time, it was presented as two things. It was presented as both a good public health initiative for all the reasons we've heard, as well as the city's broke, the schools are in trouble, this will do some good to help bring money into the coffers. Lindsay clearly knows more about this than I do, but one of the challenges the first time was one of these challenges of the patchwork nature of our states and cities and the federal government in these sorts of regulations. It turned out that the city of Philadelphia could not unilaterally impose a tax that went directly to the consumer on a single beverage in the way that tobacco taxes, for example, the cigarettes, there are state minimum prices, so that if there's a tax, it's paid at the point of purchase. So there was nothing to stop in the city proposals that tax from being absorbed by retailers, and rather than a bottle of regular Coke costing $3 and Diet Coke costing $1.39, that 2 cent per ounce that would be in the part of the total tax bill for the retailers could easily, you could dissolve it over 100 products, raise 100 products 1 cent. So it would have failed in all likelihood, that the necessary criteria, or at least the effective criteria of accomplishing something, the deterrent effect. The second time the mayor unsuccessfully tried it last year, he gave up on the public health angle, and he literally said, the schools are broke, this will raise $100 million, 2 cent per ounce tax, city council, who had to pass this, or a 10% property tax increase. Turns out the city council, as the problem of not being part of the Democratic machine to get elected, is that he has very little influence over what the city council people, who have basically lifetime tenure here in Philadelphia, for those of you who are here, who have been here, and they basically went property tax, a short property tax, couple percent, and gave the schools some money that way. So this was a challenge here where the messaging was confused, concerted lobby, PepsiCo and Coca-Cola and the Dr. Pepper Snapple people got together, there were full-page ads, an aggressive campaign advocating for freedom of choice and healthy choices and portions and all the good things these companies are doing with water and little cans and things like that. So this question of messaging, effectiveness, muddling the arguments is, I think, a really significant one that we've seen here unsuccessfully twice, how it didn't affect what its advocates intended. So I talked for too long. Josh, John, and then we'll see where we are. I'm going to go with Josh first, just since John talked a bit.
No, I'm sorry. I...
My brain's on like overdrive. I've got 7,000 things going through my head. But I guess the gist of what I've been thinking about is goes back to last week when we were talking about the United States as a melting pot and the different perceptions and different opinions and values. And it seems in many ways an unintended consequence of a very heterogeneous population that it's so difficult to get consensus. We were comparing it to like Japan, which is very homogeneous, and their sort of different cultural value system. And I just can't help but think, it's a terribly cynical thing to say, but I can't help but think that when Americans are given choices, we usually get it wrong. And I don't think that we should be...
Is that the 4th of July message for the week? Yeah. Proud to be an American, as we'll sing our way out. Yes.
They're all at Wimbledon. But it's just like, you know, you were saying giving choices oftentimes is better, and in general I like that concept, but I don't know if anybody saw Jamie Oliver's Food Revolution. It was a couple seasons, and then of course, you know, it loses funding because nobody actually wants to watch something that's worthwhile, but he tried to improve quality of food in classrooms and schools, and it costs more, first of all. And he looked at like milk, for example, and they gave you a choice of white milk, strawberry milk, chocolate milk. Nobody chose the white milk. It wasn't until the strawberry and chocolate milk were removed that the kids actually drank the white milk. And that's sort of, I think, paradigmatic of our society. And usually what happens is people say, I don't want to wear a helmet, you know, for motorcycles. You can't make me wear a helmet. And I think it's with healthcare, it's one of these things where no one can actually truly understand the downstream consequences of their action. No one, if you ask them, well, if you don't wear a helmet, and I told you today you were going to get in a horrible, disfiguring accident, you would be in a wheelchair and would have a traumatic brain injury and be completely functionless, would you wear a helmet? They'd be like, yeah, sure. But you can't predict that. And so inevitably, people say, oh, that won't happen to me, or, you know, I don't want to pay for it for somebody else, but I better get it when it's my turn. And it just seems to me like just so antithetical to what makes sense. And so there, that's all I have to say.
So I want to talk about two different surveys. One is, I find it interesting that we go to like tax private companies and go out when there's so much within the government that they could do to make their first step to VC. So, or just on all these issues. So for the motorcycle, it's a public highway. All roadways, right? You have speed limits because if you set the speed limit 55, you save 5,500 lives a year, right? You know, you give all these seatbelts. If you want to drive on our roads, you got to wear a helmet. How is that not like that? That they, where else would they be like? Well, you know, they can go fire private.
Didn't the article talk about how they tried to make that argument at one point?
Yeah, so the federal law tied highway funding, as they did with the drinking age. That was the example that states that reduced the drinking age to 18 got their highway funding. The 21 didn't, and every state got in line.
I guess I don't understand where the law the cognitive step is. What they've just said, they kind of went around that argument, and but have allowed in speed limits and other things. I don't know why helmets. They can't say that, you know, you need to have every car, you know, cars can't just be parked sideways on the highway.
But it's like you said, we spend a lot more time trying to convince people than we do just sort of doing it. And you know, again, people don't, you don't want to pay tax on sugar beverages. Well, but we pay taxes on cigarettes, and people either choose to pay the tax and smoke or they don't smoke. And nobody, most people don't complain about it. Tobacco lobby do, but most people don't complain about it because it's become part of our cultural fabric. It's just the way it is. And it almost seems like if you just did it, people would adjust to it.
But don't you think that at least in part, that's it's part of our cultural fabric because people have finally gotten the message that cigarettes are bad? Like that's what I was trying to say. Like
They taxed them before people finally realized that. They were still taxed.
Well, and but that took, as we'll see next week from the Alan Brand piece, it took a generation or two. I mean, there was lots of evidence. There was expert opinion. There was still, you know, this haze of doubt. In part through the long efforts of the pharmaceutical of the tobacco industry, pharmaceutical industry. I'm just brainwashed to blame them. Like, I'm sorry, so yes, and Aaron as well. So, but the getting these cognitive shifts often takes time and a lot of effort along the way. Noelle,
I have just a funny idea, and I probably shouldn't even say it because I'm sleep deprived. But as a pediatrician, all of a sudden it occurred to me, like, we have laws about the sales of things below a certain age, I mean, have we ever thought about saying no sugar sweetened beverages or soda to people under 18? I mean, I wonder what it would do long term to, if we could project long term, would it have an impact on obesity? I mean, do we kind of say as the child advocate, well, the horse is out of the barn with adults, they're not going to change their eating habits or what they drink, but with children, could we have an impact?
What do people think about that? Because as we've seen in other examples, the let's protect kids arguments often have lots of tractions for kinds of things that wouldn't be palatable on the whole.
I mean, the problem with that is that, you know, until you get to a certain age, most of the things that you consume are purchased for you by your parents. And I mean, and you know, if you go back to like tobacco, most people are not buying cigarettes for their 12-year-olds, you know?
Yeah.
Like, how do you control that?
Well, we're controlling it to some extent in schools, where if we say mm-hmm. you can't purchase it, mm-hmm. we're not going to have soda machines in schools.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jeff, and then Emily.
Well, one of the lines that you pulled out of the motorcycle article that I really liked was, can we coerce adults to lead healthy lives? And I wrote down underneath it, can we coerce children to lead healthy lives? What would the impact be? And I think that's the question that we're trying to ask here is, we definitely do have much stronger legal ability in this country and much more, I guess, background support for coercing children to do things than adults. And I don't know if there's any studies. I'm sure there's studies supporting that healthier children lead healthier adults. So I think that could be really interesting, because it would certainly force parents to make the decision for their kids as opposed to letting kids do it by themselves. And maybe in a generation that really would get some traction.
One quick comment to that. I mean, that also is it's a health campaign with messaging impact. So if we're banning it for kids, like that sends a strong message to adults that we think is really unhealthy. But what I raised my hand for is, before I was in my current position, I studied food marketing to kids, and I used to watch television, large segments of educational informational television programming, and we did a lot of research about like what type, how much advertising there was for unhealthy food products, and you know, food in general, and how much of that was unhealthy versus healthy. And I mean, obviously, it's not shocking, because you probably all expect how horrible it was. But and you know how few advertisements there were for healthy foods. But I think what makes obesity a little bit different is that, you know, unlike, you know, seatbelt laws or helmet laws, you need to eat to live. And how you choose to, you know, build your diet is, it's hard to tell someone what's right or what's wrong. And there's so many factors that affect if you become obese or not. So you can't say just because you ate, you know, it's hard to show like sort of this causal link. But I think that a really real problem is the messaging. I mean, kids from a young age are pushed in really, really powerful and under the radar and damaging and I think, you know, scary ways that to believe that certain things are healthy or certain things are more or certain things are cool. And you know, when I looked at the television programs, I mean, it's really no wonder our kids are obese and diabetic. And so, again, kind of cynical perspective, but and I also know that, you know, pushing, getting regulations, government regulation for food marketing advertising on television has been incredibly difficult. So if that's so hard, I can only imagine what banning soda for children would be. Like, I mean, I think that would be very hard to do.
Yeah,
that would make a lot of sense.
If I had to guess. Yeah, you know, just politically, as we see, as these things get hammered out, it's hard to imagine, you know, the Ronald McDonald, Chester Cheeto, Lucky Charms, Leprechaun, that see those characters surviving a generation from now, in the same way that Joe Camel and the other tobacco mascots with appeal to children were given up by the industry. I think that'll be an area where some concession will be made by the food manufacturers and the corporations in return for some other compromise. But it seems like that's an area where, given the child marketing and all that we've thought about so far, I suspect those folks will be the Hamburglar will be locked away for good. Katrina, you had a hand up.
Oh, I was just thinking about what you were saying about marketing to kids. And in Philadelphia, you know, when when kids are coming home from school, they see the best place to get food is easily accessible is the junk food stores. It's cheap, and they can afford that. So they have a lot of access to those kinds of foods. So it's not only just the TV messaging, which is very important, but also just what they have access to by themselves and what is influencing them. And also, who's doing the advertising and where are they doing the advertising? Who's being targeted for the advertising? People who would more likely buy those kinds of foods because they're cheaper. So that's another part of it, is a sort of a disparity issue.
Sure.
I mean, for me, we were talking about sort of forget about the banning, but about the taxing and how tobacco taxing is sort of taken and people sort of accept that. But I mean, it's pretty clear that smoking cigarettes causes cancer. I have a lung cancer. I have a little bit of a different problem with the sort of sugary drink tax because I get a little suspicious because when we talk about, I mean, they talked about the idea that they could tax and then you can use that money to actually go back and actually start addressing some of these problems. But that's not what that tax is going for. That tax is actually to pay for something else. And I wonder, in my mind, I get suspicious if that they want to do a sugary drink tax because it's easier than, I don't know, taxing trans fats or something like that. And that it's actually not to then, I mean, I guess indirectly you think you can argue that you're decreasing obesity because you're restricting access to sugary drinks or you're making people pay extra for them. But the money that you're getting is not actually going to address obesity. And it seems to me that you have to sort of think about them from the perspective, too, of what's the motivation behind the tax and whether it's really just a convenient thing to tax, and that they have some sort of argument.
But maybe we're going to talk about this next week, but is the money, I don't actually know, is the money the taxes for tobacco?
No, I mean, no, that's true. That's true. I mean, that's true.
Well,
that's,
and that is an issue. The taxes go to efforts that address obesity. I mean, like, that could be part of...
That's true, but we don't. I mean, that's not sort of what's behind, at least in Philadelphia, that's not. And it's not. I actually had I got part of a grant was actually from tobacco money, and I don't work on cancer at all.
That's, and some of that also, there's tobacco settlement money, too.
There's things along those lines, but I mean, I guess I think I don't have as much of a problem with the tax on tobacco because I think... well, it'll get complicated, but the sugary drink thing is more nebulous. There's so many causes for obesity, and it just seems that there are so many things or other ways that you could probably have as big of an impact. It's just that it's easy. It seems to be easier.
But
tax.
But forget obesity. I mean, that's fine. We can talk about obesity, and perhaps it is nebulous. But sugary drinks increase diabetes. Diabetes is an independent risk factor for coronary disease. Coronary disease is the number one killer in the United States. And so I really would like to get back to this, the very general, broad question of, can anyone in this room pose a reasonable argument against the cost concept, the harm, and that it's costing so much for rent? Because we're seeing that healthcare is becoming a limited resource. We have to deal with rationing and allocation all the time. And patients, 10% of the sickest patients in the country, that's 50% of the healthcare dollars spent on that small percentage of people that are these people, the people who are developing these diseases. Plenty of people drink sugary drinks and they'll never get diabetes. But other than that, I'm having a hard time creating an argument against it because it seems like there's a substantial amount of money that's being spent for sick people who are in many ways doing it to themselves through their dietary habits.
Probably the cost spent on type 2 diabetes are probably much more than the cost ever were on lung cancer for smoking. You know, lung cancer. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's hard.
There's a lot of causes for diabetes, though.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, that's
huge.
Yeah.
Eric?
But I think it gets back to the question, there's so many overlying combining factors. I mean, I think we have a pretty clear distinction between cigarettes and lung cancer, or even between, I'm a lot perplexed about the helmets because if you're wearing a helmet, you're in an accident, it's pretty clear, versus like in food where, you know, is it the diet, is it the exercise, is it, you know, is it portion control, is it eating out, and there's just so many different factors.
Yeah, that
unless there's a smoking gun, for lack of a better term, it's hard to say what you start with. And I think the same thing with diabetes, there's just so many different factors. So I don't know if there's one that's more palatable than the others to go with, et cetera. I think even like when you get back to sugary beverages, I mean, there's some
maybe there's an argument, you say Coca-Cola's been around for 100 years, now we have something that's diabetic injury. So what is it? Is it the sugary sweet beverages? Is it the, you know, is it the lack of exercise? Is it the portion? Is it drinking it earlier? So I think even where you have like a clear tie, it's not just a straightforward, it's, you know, it's soda because it's...
There's so many things.
There's so many different things.
But probably it's not consumption of sugary drinks as much as quantity of consumption of sugary drinks. Because 100 years ago, you didn't have the big gulp of Coca-Cola. You had a smaller Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, maybe it's the amount of sugar that's consumed that is in sugary drinks versus all the other sugar. I mean, I don't know.
Well, that's what the articles argued, is that sugary drinks have so much sugar and they're such a large part of people's diets.
I just like the idea of providing choices, like what you were saying. When you walk into a supermarket, I remember we did a field work assignment for a health literacy class. We walked into a supermarket, I think it was on 43rd, or I'm not sure which street it was, but you walk in and the first thing you see is high sugary drinks advertised. They're all sitting out in front. And after you get past that, that's when you see all the produce and the fresh fish and everything. So simply relocating things in stores sometimes can be a great benefit to people to give them other choices. Because we were really surprised. We walked in and we saw just nothing but the little cheap, you know, 10 cases of Welch's grape juice soda for whatever, $10 or whatever. That's so easy. That's really easy to do. And it fills you up and it's quick. But then, you know, just moving those to the back of the store would have been a big difference. And then going to the freezer aisle and seeing the different kinds of dinners that you have. You know, some stores have better choices than other stores. So that's one way, other than a tax, is just sort of giving people more choices.
Chuck?
But even with some nice choice architecture, we are bad choosers. Like, who here wouldn't you offer one cookie for $1 or five for two? Who is going to be like, I'm getting five cookies. And, you know, we have this whole stipulation in the harm principle, like, and for children, all these, like, under 21, well, you know, they're a vulnerable population. We are a vulnerable population, all of us. There's too many good marketers. There's too many good additives that you can put a drop of something. Oh, that's flame broil. You know, it's like, no, that's just a drop of something on your burger. There's too much. We're all vulnerable choosers. So, and as soon as we recognize that, then we can start to do the choice architecture, man, you know, move the order, but realize also that we have to recognize that we're bad choosers.
The grill marks on the Burger King burger are not real. I'm asking.
For us, you know, I just can't see it this way, and I'm just missing the point, and perhaps taxing does this, but I don't have an issue with saying that you can't charge like a cheaper amount just because it's bigger. You can't per ounce, you can't charge a cheaper per ounce price, you know, because you're buying more. That I don't have an issue with. Like, you know, I just keep going back to, in Italy, you pick out the size of pizza you want, they weigh it, and that's how much you pay. Whereas, like, you know, here that would never fly because, you know, people, you know, want the biggest for the smallest amount of price. But I don't have an issue with that, and I think the issue lies with putting the additional tax on some things and not other things. And I don't know what people think about that, but I think we could start some of these things by charging the same price per ounce, per pound, per whatever, and I don't know how difficult that is to implement.
It's bad economics unless you actually structure it that way and force people to do it. And that's kind of a hard thing to push through.
But they do it in yogurt. There's like frozen yogurt shops, and you like weigh your frozen yogurt.
That's all you get.
But if it's you go to the yogurt shop next door, it charges it cheaper. So I mean, you know, I don't know. Playing with the economics like that, I don't think.
Well, I think taxing playing with economics too.
Our whole tax system is based upon incentives And, you know, which as much as I hate our tax system, it is. It's based on we give tax breaks to incent behavior. The problem is that never, ever goes away. So if we put extra taxes on sugary beverages, that's forever. I mean, and you think they may say it's going to go here for now, but, you know, 10 years from now, it's going there. You know,
so I love the idea of weighing things because it fits the model of sort of the libertarian desire to have freedom, right? Yeah. Where it's sort of like, okay, you can choose to pay more.
I mean, simple argument, it's an economy of scale. It costs me $5 to ship one thing on a truck, but for me to add a second one onto there, it's not going to cost another $5. You know, it's taking up a marginally a little bit more space, so.
I'm not saying it's easy. I'm just saying I like it.
Yeah.
I went to a movie like 5 years ago before I had a kid, and it was like this much money for this drink or 50 cents more.
Yeah.
Like, come on, it's only 50 cents. You got to get it, right? And I'm like, you know, I'll pay 50 cents to half as much.
No, I do that too. And anybody remember Penny a Pound, like the ground round?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Free popcorn? Free student movies?
So the ground round, like the family restaurant.
Pay what you weigh.
It was Penny a Pound, and they weighed the kids. And no, like that's how much you pay for your meal. If you weigh 80 pounds, you paid 80 cents for your
meals. Awesome. Yeah.
Wow.
Who's gonna make
the
argument?
How do we get
there? Over a third of Americans are clumsily obese, right? Or who's gonna make the argument to them and say, hey, you're just you make really poor decisions. Like how does that argument fly? Or, you know, transmission of STIs, right? Why not mandate that people wear condoms? It's the same argument. Like,
It would increase the public health employment force with inspectors and whatnot.
I agree.
Let me.
And to what you said, there's some we oversimplify the problem, right? Because obesity is genetic as well. There's some people who can eat very good diets and still be obese, and a lot of it is also calories in, calories out. So it's a slippery slope to say, well, not only do we have to tax you on your food, but I'm also going to tax you if you don't exercise. Because it's calories in, calories out. So it's not just how much you eat, but also how much you work out.
I think my bigger question right there, just as a quick follow-up, is what's the desired outcome? Is the desired outcome to have lower obesity rates or to have like a healthy population? And how does that idea translate? Because when you're taxed, you're seeing it as a penalty, right? You're saying, I don't want you to be obese, and that's what messages? I don't want you to be a burden on the healthcare system. What's the flip side of that? Do we start like a propaganda campaign to be like, this is the model American citizen. It's your civic duty to be healthy. And then we start having like dioramas of like healthy. But I mean, maybe this, it doesn't seem outlandish to me. It seems like.
David?
If the goal was just to have less obesity, can you just up the standard for obesity? Like, so it's like a BMI of 25.
That's great inflation.
That's why I can't get small obesity. I think the goal has to be like health, not like lowering the obesity rate.
Cool.
So I apologize if this is at all repetitive because I stepped in late, but I was just going to add on that I think that one thing to keep in mind when we're talking about the pricing of soda is that it, part of the reason it is as cheap as it is because corn syrup is heavily subsidized by the government. And so I don't think it's totally, we're not being totally honest with ourselves if we say that the government hasn't already, to an extent, manipulated these prices, and that, you know, you're sort of splitting hairs then to complain about taxing or not taxing in that sense.
Mm-hmm. That's a fair point. Jeff?
I dared a libertarian, which was very interesting. go figure. And no, and that was one of the things he pulled in, is that, you know, oh, there's so much corn syrup and government subsidies, government's evil. I'm like, well, it doesn't mean government's evil. It means that the corn farmers, you know, 80 years ago said, we need help. And government said, we'll help you. We'll make corn really cheap. And they did, you know, we'll subsidize that. So we need to reconsider, like you were saying before, a tax is forever, a subsidy is forever, too. We need to be willing to go back and reconsider that some of that stuff didn't turn out very well. And we really need to reconsider it. And, of course, you know, farming in this country is in the hole anyway, so it's hard to figure out how to pull subsidies without making farmers even worse off. There's it's quite a balancing act.
Mm-hmm. Baraka, then I want to raise a new angle.
I was thinking of this idea, but I really don't get a reason why did they select only the beverage. Because nowadays, if you look, we have this label, nutritional label in each food item you buy, and you find that in each item, you find there is a certain amount of sugar labeled. You find that there are other products which have a lot of sugar, but we don't discuss about them. We look, the discussion menu is on beverage. How I was thinking it could be because the aim to make sure that people don't consume a lot of sugar. Why didn't they tax the amount of, exactly the amount of sugar in each item? That instead of going to beverage, because if you go to soda itself, you find that there are different type of soda, and you say that we are going to tax per weight, that how much it weighs, then you tax for that amount. There are people who say that this is not fair, because there are, you might find two different bottles of soda with two different amount of sugar, but they'll be taxed the same. Mm-hmm. So I would think that it could be reasonable that each tax would be depend on the amount of sugar in that particular item.
Mm-hmm. I suspect, just to offer the response by our folks here who can't speak for themselves, would be one that these incremental actions don't preclude, ignore the fact that there's a broader problem needing to be addressed. I wonder whether they would ask about percent content, how they would chime into that. But again, that soda has been identified as a particularly harmful variety of sugar delivery systems, as far as the empty calorie nature of it, the ubiquity of it. I suspect that they would say this is a low-hanging fruit that starts what? You know, I suspect if you ask, you know, Kelly Brownell at Yale, who's the dean of these folks and other food policy scholars and even an activist, I think he wouldn't be afraid to be called, would probably suggest that this would be the first part of a more comprehensive program to influence decision making, to put it that way.
Is it just sugary soda, or is it all soda? Can you walk around a 40 of Coke Zero?
Yes, which, thank God, if that existed, my life would be would be quite sick. So yeah, so yeah, so yeah, so, so, so yeah. Exactly, and that's been the argument now too. Is the artificial sweeteners, have a class of risks to themselves. So it's a matter of where we start. I want to ask. I have two other angles I want to cover in the last 15 minutes. One that struck me, and hopefully many of you, as we were reading these pieces, that except for the Faden piece, which I should note is a generation old, but I thought it raised important themes that showed both their persistence in the debate as well as their continued relevance. And Professor Faden is one of the leading part of the leading cohort of public health ethicists. But these other pieces by leaders in these fields in premier journals like the New England Journal of Medicine and Health Affairs, I was struck by clearly how relevant many of the questions of ethics and values we've been thinking about all summer long are to these discussions, but how latent they are in the actual arguments raised, that we don't hear about the questions of solidarity or a communitarian spirit or the responsibilities of individuals for one another or duty or the kinds of buzzwords, for lack of a better word, the kinds of things that have motivated our discussions and that are clearly here in the minds of advocates. And I don't think it's just a sample size thing, because if there were more explicit things, I think I would have found them and I would have hoped we would have included them. Can we make anything from that by why those kinds of discussions, those kinds of appeals don't appear, where instead we hear about data and evidence and causation and healthcare costs and those sorts of things? What can we make of that, if anything? Yeah.
I think they don't want to enter the justification debate. If they plow past it, like, this is, of course this is right. Look at all these people getting
overweight, if they don't say, we should think about society as a whole, if they skip it, I think that's the hidden message. Because if you step back, I don't necessarily think that if you play the game of the free will, then as soon as you say someone's limited my choice, then as an American, I'm upset, even if I haven't heard the rest of what you're saying.
Yeah, I'm just not sure it resonates with Americans, this idea of duty,
yeah,
right? Because we're really a fairly selfish society, and duty is really about others, not about self, right?
That's a long...
Oh, I'm sorry. No. That's okay. I don't know. I mean, it may be because we blame people for being obese. You've done this to yourself. You know, it's not like, you know, I don't need to help you out with this because you could have just fixed it on your own.
Mm-hmm. So this personal responsibility question, which me and Brown Allen then come back to this question of how those personal choices shape it. Michael, you wanted to...
I think it's a long leap to most people to think what I'm doing has societal,
mm-hmm.
Or anybody cares from that standpoint. Mm-hmm. You know, actually, I resonate a lot with the personal responsibility, but, you know, I necessarily agree with the article, but I think there's a lot to personal responsibility, and most of the things I've read that sort of try to debate that more looks to find excuses why people can't take responsibility for themselves, you know.
And that one as well does acknowledge the community factors,
right.
that
so it's I'm a strong advocate that personal responsibility is an important part of of what should happen as well.
I think it's interesting with obesity that you have the community, like people don't understand, I think, that if I eat these Cheetos every day, I'm going to get fat, let alone that, like, that is how that affects society. It's, like, twice removed, you know? So I think even the link, like, we're still targeting, like, these foods and this behavior affects you, let alone extrapolating it to society. So I think that could be why it's not...
I think we're also a highly educated group. I think there's major gaps in education where people just really don't know that certain foods will make them fat and will make them more at risk for really serious diseases. So I think that, and not that I am a proponent of the education, like I do think we need interventions, but I think that going on our knowledge of nutrition probably is not representative of the larger... the larger American community.
I want to get back to education. Let's see what else is on the table. Dave?
I was going to say, maybe also part of the benefit of putting responsibility on others is that I get to feel better about myself. For, like, I'm a responsible adult because I'm not obese. Right? So, like, part of that, like, I don't know, getting to put myself up by putting other people down type of situation.
So we haven't said much about educational campaigns, the things sort of at that low end of the problematic, you know, restricting choice continuum. But that doesn't mean that the educational campaigns are not active parts of this sort of tool chest of public health groups. And again, New York has been particularly prominent in some of these attempts to really, it's almost a scared straight type kinds of things, that, you know, there's a multi-front set of initiatives, some of which we've talked about, some of which have been considered. There was this one, this print ad that showed up on subways. I don't know if people have seen this. Again, it's my low-tech AV here, but it's a gentleman who has one leg amputated below the knee and says, portions have grown, so has type 2 diabetes, which can lead to amputations. And then we have a little bar graph that starts with then and now, and it says, cut your portions, cut your risk, call 311 for your healthy eating packet. New York City Department of Health, Michael Bloomberg, mayor. And people see the backstory about this particular story. Turns out it was an actor who they actually photoshopped, who doesn't have diabetes. They photoshopped a stock photo that they had photoshopped away one of his
legs.
Maybe, yeah, one of his legs.
He took his face on.
Yeah, so you can't see his face.
I have a huge problem with this advertising.
Tell me why.
Because obesity is not the cause of an unhealthy lifestyle. It is the effect of an unhealthy lifestyle. There's a huge bias against obesity in this country. People don't like, in many cases, don't like fat people. And you show pictures of beautiful women, and then you show in this picture, the salient point should be that he's missing a leg, not that he's obese. But what people see is that he's morbidly obese. Why not have a thin person missing a leg. Because it's irrelevant, right? And if you improve people's health, some people will get more thin, others won't, but everyone will be healthier. So that, I think we've totally missed the boat on what we should be advocating for. And one of the reasons why is it's easy to see someone who's obese. You can't see someone with heart disease, right? But what we've started to do, what they do in other countries is they have these graphic commercials that scare the crap out of you and make you want to wear a seatbelt. In New Zealand, I saw this commercial, and there's someone who's like hemorrhaging on camera, right? And I don't know if you've seen that commercial. Again, it's for smoking, but you've seen the commercial from the American Lung Association, and there's someone who's talking with the voice box, or they've got a hole from where they had their vocal cords cut out. Like, these are graphic commercials. I think that is more beneficial.
I've got graphic commercials.
Yeah,
segue
perfectly. they're more pronounced, I think, for things other than obesity. But these are a couple examples here. I have the internet here.
I mean, Morgan Spurlock. What was convincing to me in his movie was not that he gained so much weight. What was convincing to me as a physician was that he had like acute liver injury, fatty liver disease. That is what scared me, because anybody can get that. You don't have to be overweight to get that.
Well, man drinking fat pretty much gives away the punchline here. My computer, God forsake, is running very slow. Come on, big one. Absolutely. We're having this whispering. You say it out loud. It's a good point.
I was just going to say that the problem with focusing on calories, if you walk into Starbucks and all you see is calorie count, this gives a message to the entire, population of little girls who already think they should be on diets when they're 7 years old. And we've got this huge issue with fat in this country, and especially for women. And focusing on calories as opposed to healthfulness is, I think, a huge problem.
Right. And by the way, BMI of under 18 increases mortality.
Right. It's the phase. Like you said, I just said it. I was like, well, eating this makes you, like, what I meant was unhealthy, but it's the face of the disease that you've become associated with,
And it becomes a stigma, right? And that doesn't help anybody, because then we get the situation, exactly what you were saying, which is, I win. I'm not fat. Yeah. I'm healthy. Why am I going to pay for somebody else?
Well, this is not graphic, but I think it's powerful, and it was controversial. Speaking of stigma.
Mom, why am I fat?
I've got two more here. I have to sort of pop into another program here. Oh, here's that story. It's time to pick up on the Photoshop.
Did you put
on
diabetes?
I don't know enough in science about these. I mean, there's certainly a lot of investment in them. This one here.
One more.
Find it here.
It's really effective, right? But we're associating fat with that.
Does this sound familiar? You grab a mid-morning soda, a sweetened tea at lunch, a frozen coffee drink in the afternoon, and a couple of sodas at dinner. Seems harmless enough. But that many sugary drinks a day can add up to a lot of extra sugar. And all that sugar can bring on serious health problems, including obesity, which causes type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and even some cancers. So don't drink yourself sick. Go with water, seltzer, fat-free milk, or unsweetened teas instead.
So here's why these things struck a chord with me from what we had seen today, and even the Faden piece that basically tried to compare manipulation to, what's the other word they use, persuasion, was the dichotomy there. And she said, again, this was a generation ago, that you know, generally, I think, you know, what's the line here? Public health issues, public health campaigns are almost never a question of persuasion. Never a question of manipulation. That's what's happening from the messages that public health folks are trying to counter. So I wondered whether that's really the case, given the power of these messages, and also the fact that there are lots of reasons that people are morbidly obese and are riding around in you know, little motorized scooters, or lots of reasons, you know, through no personal failing, why individuals may have had to have a leg amputated due to diabetes or otherwise. And it, you know, it worries me that the for every well-intentioned effort by public health folks to show the harmful consequences, there's a whole community there that have now become the poster child for what you don't want to be. This is a problem with autism and vaccines, that, you know, people who are concerned about autism among vaccines talk about their children being vaccine damaged, and the community of people who care first and foremost about autism say, no, our kids aren't damaged, they're people who have special needs and ought to be cherished and valued. So I wonder how, I don't know what the question is here, I wonder whether people agree with me, I guess is what I'll say long-windedly, about this personal responsibility stigmatizing groups that are already, I think as Josh noted, have a DAC stacked against them societally and stigma-wise too, and whether this is appropriate, whether these things are serious, and you know what, we need to act seriously to convey the gravity, or whether this goes too far, Robin.
My impression in reference to all of these cases or examples, it's like the limit is too much, you know, for one individual person. Like, when you see those ads and you're looking at it, it's difficult. I mean, we're all like, you know, it really moves you in one direction or the other, and that's what bothers me about it. Because in reference to making the argument, it has to be, I feel like it has to be balanced. You know?
How so? So what's the, how do you balance?
Exactly. That's the difficult piece. I mean, there's lots of examples that have been mentioned around the table. And which way to go, we don't really know. And there's no clear mechanism to, like, take all those examples and move in a direction one way or the other. So that's my problem with it. It kind of, like, incites feelings, you know. People get angry, you know, they take a side, and it might be offensive, or, you know, I think that it has to be something that, in reference to the ethical argument, to bring you somewhere so you can make that argument rationally and not be at one extreme or the other, or push someone so far, like these commercials. I mean,
so too far, you think?
Yeah.
One or two last points, Justin, and then Arjun.
And sort of going along with that, I was thinking of one piece that I think a lot of times the shock value can render something ineffective. I mean, you know, I've been seeing commercials like this for a long time. There's all kinds of junk food that I like to eat. I have started eating a lot healthier and exercising more and things like that. This year, and the reason is that I've been through a year of medical school. Now, not, you know, you can't send everyone to medical school, but my point is, you know, I started learning a lot of facts. This is really not a good idea, and that was a lot more effective than watching a guy drink a glass of fat. You know, so I mean, I agree with you that getting it out there so that people can think about it in a rational way is maybe more effective.
Mm-hmm. Arjun, Noel, and we'll wrap up.
So I just have a few points. So the first is that I think for somebody who doesn't have a lot of education about what causes obesity, I have two problems with this. One is that it makes it seem like if you just don't drink sugary drinks, then you're good. You can eat whatever else you want. So it's like, okay, I'll just stop drinking sugary drinks and I'll just eat cake instead. And then the second thing is just that they make it seem like there's a direct correlation between, you know, eating these kind of foods and becoming obese, because I mean, it's just that's not really the reality. There's plenty of people who drink sugary drinks like that all the time and don't get obese. There's plenty of people who don't and do. So, and the last thing is just that I think you can, education is obviously a huge, something that will definitely help, but at the same time, when you're, you know, in West Philly on like 54th Street and you're walking down the street and the only things available are like the Chinese food, which isn't, you know, the Chinese food, the pizza place, you know, there's just no, the bodega, there's just, there's no healthy options that are affordable. So what do you, I mean, are you going to take a bus, two buses to go to a grocery store to get healthy food and bring it all the way back when you're working two jobs? They're just like, as much as, even if people are educated about it, it's not feasible right now.
Mm-hmm. So the food deserts concept that people are trying to fix, no one gets less work.
I just was thinking, with advertising, I'm actually impressed by the commercial for smoking with the man who lost his wife at 44. I think what's impressive about that is it gets beyond the person who died to a bigger circle, the loss that this man experienced. It doesn't go so far as what you said, the solidarity. Doesn't do another circle around that, but at least it shows the loss of what the loss experienced. And I think that's not what's in these. And I think that's a powerful message. And it's a good education piece, I think, because in pediatrics, we talk about kids who see violent TV don't see what happens afterwards, so they don't see the loss feeling, and I think that touches us in a different way.
Mm-hmm. So we have a complicated problem, one that clearly is a significant threat to has significant consequences to public health, to the health of individuals, and one for which there is a spectrum of options available, and none of them are unproblematic, and a cluster of public health authorities throughout the country all trying different things, but we shouldn't lose sight of the underlying questions or the underlying assumptions that motivate those choices about which policies to pursue, how to frame them, how to argue for them, and how to sort of build public support to affect the change that public health advocates, regardless of how they approach it, want to do. We'll see a very similar story with different kinds of evidence, different kinds of attitudes, and different kinds of movements against it next week with tobacco. So I will see you all then. And as you go out, the first two batches of lead discussants from the first weeks 3 and 4, I've got your papers here. You can pick up on your way out. So thanks very much, and see you next week.